And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Tuesday, February 4th, 2025. Traders at Juba's Jebel Market say they have no money for taking care of soldiers deployed to protect the market.
But I was asking them, every month they're claiming that there is money for the security, 40,000. Like me, I'm paying 40,000 here. So I was asking them, where is this money going? Because 40,000 in all these shops, I think it's enough. So they were forcing us to pay.
And victims of South Sudan's 2013 conflict look for justice.
This court will not, the hybrid court will not come into being unless the government of South Sudan passes a legislature.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Traders at Juba's Jebel Market have refused to pay for services provided to soldiers who protected the market during the recent protest over the killing of South Sudanese in Sudan's town of Wad Medani. The Chamber of Commerce at the market says it borrowed money to provide food to the soldiers. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Traders at Jebel Market are rejecting a call from the Chamber of Commerce to pay for food given to soldiers from the South Sudan People's Defense Force, or SSPDF. The troops were sent to the market during the recent anti-Sudanese protests across the country. Charles Oloya, a trader at Jebel Market, says he pays a monthly security fee of 40,000 South Sudan pounds to the chamber.
They were claiming that there is one guy who was paying the money for feeding them and water. So it was like 27 million. So they told us that we have to contribute. Like here they came, they want 300,000. The other bigger doers are saying that they want 500,000. But I was asking them, every month they're claiming that there is money for the security, 40,000. Like me, I'm paying 40,000 here. So I was asking them, where is this money going? Because 40,000 in all these shops, I think it's enough. So they were forcing us to pay.
Emmanuel Confucius is the chairperson for the Chamber of Commerce in Jebel Market. He says over 300 soldiers were deployed to the market at the request of the traders during the anti-Sudan protests.
The first day they gave them 3 million from Qatar. The second day, they gave them 3.65. This they gave to those commanders of the soldiers. Immediately, they put in their car and they go. So, feeding, morning, evening, water, these 300 people. So, we borrow this money. Now, they credit it 18 million. How to contribute these people? Then, they said, let them form the committee to go and collect the money. If somebody gives them 200, it's okay. They give them 15, it's okay. The others give them 20, it's okay. That's to contribute that amount.
A trader who only identified himself as Joseph, for fear of reprisal from the Chamber of Commerce, asks why the soldiers have to be paid, even though the traders pay taxes to the government.
If we are the ones paying the National Army to protect the nation, what is the work of the government? This is the work of the government, because anything the government wants from traders, we have paid. They want the license, we pay. Money for security, money to keep Juba clean and green, we have paid. Now for protection of the people and their property, should we be the ones to pay? As a trader in Jebel Zone, this is not right and very wrong.
Lurai Kong, the spokesperson of the South Sudan People's Defense Force, says the government pays its soldiers to protect the people and their property.
SSPDF and other organized forces are employees of the government, and that's why they are on the payroll of the government. And whenever, at the end of every month, they are paid for service they render. So why would they be paid twice? If it was done, it was an extortion by some individuals within the organized forces, and it is an acceptable.
During the anti-Sudan protests last month, several shops were looted in Juba, prompting the deployment of security forces in market for weeks. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Still in Juba, the revitalized peace agreement mandated the establishment of a hybrid court to address war crimes and atrocities committed during South Sudan's 2013 conflict. However, more than 7 years later, the court is yet to be established, raising doubts about accountability and justice for the victims of the conflict. For VOA News, Sheila Pony has more from Juba.
Chapter 5 of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement focuses on transitional justice, outlining mechanisms for addressing past grievances, promoting reconciliation and ensuring accountability for human rights violations committed during the civil war. Key components include the establishment of a hybrid court to investigate and prosecute those responsible for crimes against humanity and war crimes, along with the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing, and the Reparation and Compensation Authority. Michael Makwe, Minister of Information in South Sudan's Revitalized Transitional Government of National Unity, says under the agreement, the government is not responsible for forming the hybrid court.
The formation of the hybrid court is not in our hands. It is the African Union. She's supposed to give us the terms and terms of the formation, terms and conditions for the enactment of the law.
Makwe also says the delay is procedural, emphasizing that South Sudan cannot act unilaterally.
Because this court will not, the hybrid court will not come into being unless the government of South Sudan passes a legislation. And the agreement says the terms and conditions for the establishment of this shall be provided by the African Union. The African Union up to now has not yet given us any terms and conditions, so that based on these terms and conditions, the Ministry of Justice will draft a bill.
Jerome Makoma Biswaro, the African Union envoy to South Sudan, says the African Union has been working on the issue.
The AU is now starting to draft the guidelines, which will be shared with the government. And once that is agreed upon by the two parties, then things will go as planned.
The Revitalized Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, an international body that monitors the implementation of the 2018 agreement, says the parties to the deal are responsible for forming the court. The chairperson of Commission, Ambassador General Charles Tai Gitwai, says his group will continue to remind the parties about their obligations.
RJMEC has robustly pushed for the establishment of a court in various ways. For example, through holding regular RJMEC plenary meetings on the stressing for the need to have the establishment of this court. Also through RJMEC plenary resolutions, we have issued regular plenaries in regard to having this court established. And also through the RJMEC working committees on transitional justice, these committees have always been talking about the need to have this court established. And RJMEC has pushed for the establishment of this court directly to the African Union Commission, the African Peace and Security Council, and also the African Union C5, chaired by South Africa.
Gitwai says the African Union Commission holds the primary responsibility for establishing the court.
It is incumbent upon the African Union Commission to provide the terms on the establishment of a hybrid court. Our understanding is that the African Union Commission is now drafting these terms of establishing the hybrid court of South Sudan and should be able to submit them to the RTGNU for consensus.
Timo Olknan, the European Union ambassador to South Sudan, says EU has been advocating for the implementation of the peace agreement, including the transitional justice provisions.
South Sudan needs to move forward. And in order to move forward, it needs to have a democratization process, it needs to have the elections, it needs to have a new constitution in terms of establishing a new social contract between the rulers and their people. And it also needs national healing. And, without this kind of a process of going through the past and what has happened in the past, especially the traumatic past that South Sudan has, it needs to address these issues.
The implementation of the delay extends beyond justice. Victims of human rights violations in South Sudan continue to wait for accountability, and there are concerns the lack of justice could fuel future conflict. Gitwai says the establishment of the hybrid court is crucial for lasting peace in South Sudan.
We encourage the people of South Sudan to continue calling on the RTGNU fully fired and ensure full implementation of the agreement. This is one critical way that justice and equality, important prevention of future conflict, will eventually be achieved in South Sudan.
South Sudan has promised to hold elections in 2026, and some observers of the transitions say delayed justice could hamper preparations for the polls. For VOA News, I am Sheila Aponi.
From South Sudan, we move to Sudan, where on the Chad's border with Darfur, VOA met refugees who have told harrowing stories of what the United States has described as acts of genocide in Sudan, allegedly by the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF. As the refugees call for action, the United States has imposed sanctions on leaders of the RSF and associated militias. Henry Wilkins reports from Adre, Chad.
Noor al-Latif is a refugee who, like hundreds of thousands of others, fled to Chad from Sudan's Darfur region to escape ethnic violence over the last 2 years. She's also a trained psychologist and now spends her days in the refugee camp on the Chad-Darfur border, giving psychological support to victims.
The psychological trauma is overwhelming. The loss of loved ones is immense. Death has become too frequent. Some families have lost both parents. In such cases, the child becomes the caretaker.
Al-Latif says she works with a 14-year-old girl who became head of the family after both parents were killed. VOA spent more than a week in the refugee camp in Adre speaking to victims.
Practically everybody here at the refugee site in Adre has got a horrific story to tell about friends, family members, neighbours being murdered in what the US has called a genocide.
And the US says other crimes against humanity are also taking place. The name of this refugee has been changed and her identity protected for fear of reprisals if she returns to Darfur.
They killed my mother and my brother. They killed them in my house. They killed a lot of people.
She says she was then raped by militias linked to the paramilitary rapid support forces, or RSF. Mohamed Idris Adam, a well-known artist in the Darfuri city of El Janina, says he was on an RSF hit list. He fled the city but left everything he owned, including his life's work, behind.
The whole world condemns violations of human rights, and they have agreements under the United Nations and so on. The people responsible should be brought to trial for the crimes committed in Darfur.
Okay. The US has sanctioned the RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and other senior members of the group. Meanwhile, the victim's trauma continues, says Al-Latif, and for many, it seems to get worse at night.
During the day, they all seem fine, but at night, it's all screaming and chaos in the streets. It's unbelievable.
Although the Darfuris in Adre were lucky enough to escape, they still live with the horror of what happened. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
Still in Sudan, shelling by Sudanese paramilitaries killed five people outside one of the last medical facilities operating in Khartoum's sister city of Omdurman on Tuesday. A medical source told the French news agency AFP that volunteers at Al-Noor Hospital were among the dead in the bombardment by the paramilitary rapid support forces. Gains by the army in Khartoum in recent weeks prompted the RSF to announce a counter-offensive last week. In western region of Darfur, a military airstrike Monday on South Darfur's capital killed 25 people and wounded 63. On Saturday, at least 60 people were killed in an RSF bombardment that hit a busy market in Omdurman. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Uganda's Supreme Court ruled that trying civilians in military courts is unconstitutional. Find out why after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Uganda's Supreme Court recently ruled that trying civilians in military courts is unconstitutional. Human rights groups welcome the decision as a major step in protecting the right to fair trial. The government has criticized the move, as Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Human Rights Watch is one of the groups welcoming the High Court's decision, which holds many criminal trials involving civilians in military courts. Human Rights Watch senior researcher Oriem Nyeko said the decision is encouraging.
I think it is a really important ruling and very positive. I think that it really reflects the values of human rights, of the right to a free trial that many people have been advocating for a very long time. Civilians should not be tried at military courts. That's something that is agreed at many levels, including in international law.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni criticized the ruling, saying the country is not governed by judges, but by the people. Museveni defended the military courts, saying its trials reinforce the civilian judicial system to defend the lives of people against armed criminals. According to rights groups, Ugandan military courts have tried hundreds of civilians, including opposition politicians and government critics. In 2016, former parliament member Michael Kabizunguruka was charged with security-related offences and tried in a military court. In successfully petitioning the Supreme Court, he argued that it was against the law for him and other civilians to face a general court-martial, GCM.
By its establishment, it was irregular, it was incapable of dispensing justice. And so anybody who went there did not expect justice to be served. The GCM hitherto has been used as a tool of repression by the current government, where political opponents have been taken. It has been used as a political tool just to fight the opposition, nothing else.
The court's ruling has given hope to opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who was abducted in Kenya in November and days later appeared before a military court in Kampala. He faces a death penalty for treason. Despite the High Court ruling, his court-martial case is expected to continue. Army spokesperson Chris Magenzi said a military court can try any person accused of conspiring to kill the president or commits armed rebellion or terrorism against Uganda. Kabazinguruka says the Supreme Court ruling over the court's martial issue is final.
I've read a document that is attributed to the president, and I don't want to pay so much attention to it because under our laws, he has nothing else to do but except to fully implement the ruling or the judgment of the Supreme Court. He can rant, he can do so many things, but he cannot change a ruling.
He also says civilian defendants in military courts are treated poorly.
Before you get to the court, you are tortured by these soldiers. You know, once you're in their custody, the kind of torture you go through is very, very tough on you and it leaves an indelible mark on you.
Museveni argues that military courts are beneficial to the country's security and ordered the Attorney General to propose constitutional amendments to prevent judges from interfering with their work. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to the United States, where President Donald Trump's weekend announcement of tariffs on Canada, China, and Mexico sent global markets in a downward spiral Monday. They recovered some lost ground when Trump announced he would postpone a 25% tariff on Mexican goods for a month in exchange for concessions. He later announced a similar pause with Canada. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Other countries charge us tariffs.
President Donald Trump's weekend tariff announcement is being felt in Ottawa, in Mexico City, in Beijing, and here in New York, Hong Kong, Seoul, and Taipei. Around the world, markets fell Monday after Trump dropped 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada and 10% on China. In Washington, Trump spoke of his agreement Monday with Mexico to pause the tariffs for a month in exchange for concessions from Mexico City, meant to stop migration flows and the movement of illegal drugs across the southern border. Markets quickly made up some losses after his announcement. He also announced a similar pause with Canada later on Monday.
We have to stop people from pouring in, and we have to stop fentanyl, and that includes China. Fentanyl has killed this year at least 200,000 people. It's pouring in from China through Mexico and Canada, and they've got to stop it. And if they don't stop it, the tariffs are going to get worse, a lot worse.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum sounded a hopeful note on Monday.
I'm sure that in this month we'll be able to have results, good results for your people, good results for the people of Mexico. And this was the result of the agreement. It was a good conversation, with respect.
Economic scholars say consumers will start to feel the pinch soon and pointed to historical parallels. Steve Kamen is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
This brings us back to the 1930s, you know, when, as you may recall, a trade war was one of the factors that deepened the Great Depression as economies all over the world erected barriers in order to keep imports out. In the longer term, keeping tariffs high would end up reducing the total amount of global trade, which would diminish competition and reduce the diffusion across the world of technological innovations. And that could end up, over a longer term, reducing the pace of U.S. and global economic growth.
China's ambassador to the United Nations, Fu Kong, on Monday said Beijing would turn to the World Trade Organization for recourse.
We do believe that this is in violation of the WTO rules. So that's why China is filing a complaint at this WTO. And we may be forced to take countermeasures. And let me also emphasize that there is no winner in a trade war.
Trump acknowledged that the move would raise prices, but said the higher tariffs would be worth the price to bolster U.S. interests. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Still in the United States, the recent outbreak of the H5N1 avian influenza virus and the potential for it to mutate has raised concerns among the scientific community that it could result in human-to-human transmission and a new pandemic. Farmers are also concerned about the potential impacts to their livelihood. VOA's Veronica Baldras Iglesias reports.
Feeding time.
George Terwilliger runs Pleasant Vale Farm in Delaplaine, Virginia, west of Washington. He has modified his small-scale operation due to the H5N1 avian influenza virus. The so-called bird flu has resulted in not only a high U.S. bird mortality since 2022, but also a sharp increase in the price of eggs nationwide.
We here on this farm have not expanded our chickens over the last year or two out of fear that we might inadvertently bring birds in that are infected.
Terwilliger, a member of the Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources Board, is also concerned about the risk bird flu could pose to his hogs and to about 100 cows and calves that he owns.
If the disease were to get to the point where it infects cattle and makes them sick or makes their meat, these are beef cattle, makes their meat unacceptable, that would put us out of business.
Bird flu in dairy cows was first reported in late March. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the public health risk remains low, with just 67 confirmed infections from animals to humans and one death. Constant changes in the genome of the virus, however, have some scientists worried. Megan Davies is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She spoke via Skype.
If there are changes that make it more possible for the virus to transmit from person to person, which so far we haven't seen, then that could be a real challenge in terms of our public health response and is the reason that we think of this virus as having pandemic potential.
People can minimize the risk of infection, Davies added.
Avoiding contact with sick or dead wild animals is probably the most important thing to do. We know that pasteurization of milk, cooking of meat to the recommended temperatures, and cooking of eggs are effective to really inactivate this particular virus.
Pet owners are advised to monitor recalls of contaminated pet food and raw milk and to keep their pets away from contact with wild birds. As he keeps a watchful eye on the latest developments, Terwilliger is planning ahead.
Typically, sometime a month or so from now, we would buy turkey poults to raise turkeys for commercial sale at Thanksgiving. I'm not sure we'll do that this year because I would be concerned about where I get the birds from. Will they come with avian flu?
In the meantime, he says he'll follow the science and hopes that the disease runs its course, all while keeping a very close eye on his livestock. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Delaplain, Virginia.
And that report by Iglesias brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday, February 4th, 2025. We now leave you with Colonel Mido and the song Nani Ongere. This one goes to our listeners in Eastern Equatorial State. We've been listening to Colonel Mido and the song Nani Ongere. And to our listeners in Eastern Equatorial State, we say VOA Ongere. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. For more information on our programs, log on to www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Justin Twist, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Why you keep your boy on the